Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The United States Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit is now open according to law. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning and welcome to our second day of this calendar. Our Zoom transmission worked pretty well yesterday, so we're hoping it all goes well today. And Judge Lagoa, Judge Brasher, and I are very happy to have all of you with us. You'll see a timer on the screen that is going to try to replicate the timer you would have had in the courtroom. When the numbers go yellow, that means that your time is about to run out, so you should start to wrap up. If we take you beyond the red timer, then don't worry about it. You're on our time and not yours. And with that, we're ready to begin with our first case, which is number 19-10308, Jerome Williams versus the United States. Mr. Smith.
Thank you, Your Honor. Toby Smith, representing Jerome Williams. May it please the court. When Mr. Williams was sentenced in 1998, clear principles in this court's precedents established that his 1977 federal kidnapping conviction could not have been a violent felony under either the ACCA's enumerated clause or its elements clause. Because of that, his sentence is identifiable as one that more likely than not was based solely on the ACCA's vague residual clause. When I speak of the law at the time of sentencing, really I'm talking about three specific matters. First, the elements of federal kidnapping, which had long been recognized not to require the use or threat of force. Two, this court's application of the elements clause, which in 1998 was very clear and strict that the court would look only to the statutory elements in the definition of the offense and not look to offense conduct in applying the elements clause. And the third specific matter I'm referring to is classifications of kidnapping and other similar offenses under the ACCA and crime of violence definitions. Now, the third of those has taken on kind of an outsized prominence in the briefs because the first and second really were extremely clear. There wasn't any room for argument that kidnapping has an element of use or threat of force. And it also was, throughout the 90s in this circuit's precedents, very clear that the court would not look to offense conduct in applying the elements clause. It would only look to the statutory elements.
Mr. Smith, can I ask you a question? And you don't have to answer it immediately, but I'd like you to try to address it at some point during your argument. What do we do with the modified categorical approach and your client's non-objection to the offense conduct for the prior convictions in the pre-sentence investigation report?
Your Honor, I'll answer that immediately. After Shepard, there was a shift in this circuit's precedence after Shepard. Shepard, of course, was decided in 2005, 7 years after Mr. Williams was sentenced. And after Shepard, this court did, between Shepard and DeCamp, really, begin to look more often at offense details. But in 1998, you know, we're talking, when we talk about the elements clause, we're talking about a provision that encompasses offenses that have as an element the use or threat of force. And this court in the 90s applied that provision faithfully according to its text. And I would go back to the, even in 1990, shortly before Taylor, I believe, in United States versus Gonzalez Lopez, which is cited in our brief, but quickly, it's 9/11 Federal 2nd 542. This court said the phrase as an element only permits an examination of the statute, not a particular conduct of the defendant on the day the crime was committed. So the the more facts-focused modified categorical approach that this court applied before DeCamp was a fairly novel development in the circuit's jurisprudence. It wasn't an approach the court was taking in 1998, and I think the precedents back that up. It continued on past 2000. In 2001, the Fulford decision reiterated what Gonzalez-Lopez had said, also reiterated a similar statement from the 1994 decision in United States versus Oliver. So I don't believe that, although the government's brief has suggested it and has cited post-Shepherd authorities to as a basis for that argument, I don't believe that there was any question under the precedents at the time of sentencing that the sentencing court couldn't look to the offense details in the pre-sentence report. It had to look only to the statutory elements.
All right, thank you.
Is there another question?
No, not for me, thank you.
Well, let me interrupt and ask you a question.
Yes, Your Honor.
So the way I see the district court's decision, I think probably the government's argument, is that we have said in previous cases that this issue is a question of historical fact, right? What was the judge thinking at the time of the sentence? And I don't think anyone disagrees with your read of the law at the time, but I think the district court at least was suggesting that the law just doesn't tell us what the judge was thinking at the time, and that as a matter of historical fact, maybe we just don't know what the judge was thinking. And so what do you say about that?
I think that I have 2 points about that. First is that I think you're right about the judge saying, essentially, I can't tell you about this historical fact. You know, this, when I'm writing this opinion, Judge Smith is saying 21 years had passed. He didn't purport to remember what he did 21 years before, or even more generally, how he was applying the elements clause or the residual clause. So we don't come, even though it is labeled as a question of historical fact, the evidence he looked at to decide that historical fact was purely legal evidence. It was purely the evidence from the precedents that were in place at the time of sentencing. And that puts us in a different posture on appeal, because he didn't make the kind of finding of fact that turns on credibility determinations or on weighing evidence other than simply the legal evidence. That's why we've argued that essentially the question before this court is a question of law that this court can and should decide de novo, because because it is a question of what this court's precedents more likely than not would have, what result they would have produced more likely than not in 1998.
May I ask you a question? There's the decision, the Pickett decision, where I believe Judge Marcus wrote that the district court should consider in the first instance whether Pickett can show as a historical fact that he was more likely than not sentenced under only the residual clause. Is there anything in the record that shows that the district court at the time of sentencing relied solely on the residual clause?
So this is, well, the short answer is there's nothing in the record as far as the sentencing record, the transcript, the pre-sentence report. There's nothing that identifies any particular clause. So that means that the only available evidence is the evidence regarding the state of the law in 1998. That evidence, we believe, really does show that it is more likely than not that the district court relied, or the sentencing court, relied only on the residual clause, because that's the only ACCA clause that this court's precedents would have allowed, you know, assuming they were applied faithfully, which is something I think we can and should assume, the residual clause is the only one that would have been able to cover a kidnapping offense. Clearly, kidnapping is not an enumerated offense. And the elements clause, as I was just saying in response to Judge Jordan, the elements clause was applied by looking only to the statutory elements. And since 1946, at least, the Supreme Court's Chapman decision had made clear that federal kidnapping could be committed by simply deception or purely mental restraint. That's just what the text of the kidnapping statute says as well. Even though there was no on-point precedent that had already said in this circuit as a binding matter, kidnapping is a residual clause offense, the residual clause was the only reservoir into which this sentence could be placed under the ACCA's three clauses.
But isn't that always going to be the case when you bring one of these claims? Because if that weren't the case, then your claim would fail because another clause would apply, right? So isn't it always going to be the case when you bring one of these claims that the other clauses wouldn't apply?
I don't think that's been what I've seen in Johnson 2255 decisions out of this court. There have been a lot where there's been a very clear question about whether a lot involving burglary, for instance, where there's been a very close question, or maybe not even that close, about whether burglary would have been a generic burglary that fell under the enumerated clause. There have been decisions involving prior assault convictions and whether those would have fallen under the elements clause based on the divisibility jurisprudence or lack thereof at the time. Those things, no, I don't think that's true. I am nearly
just to understand, you're pointing to the clarity of that issue in this case as something that would distinguish it from other cases where the issue would still be, in all these cases, we would still have to decide whether the crime fell under the elements clause or the enumerated clause. But in this case, you're saying it was really clear that it didn't.
Couldn't fall under, if the sentencing court faithfully applied binding precedent, it could not have been placed under the enumerated or the elements. Yes, Your Honor. I'll wait for my rebuttal. Thank you.
All right, thank you very much, Mr. Smith. Okay, Mr. Billingsley.
May it please the court. Good morning. Michael Billingsley for the United States. We think this case is essentially identical to Pickett in terms of the pre-remand record in that case. In that case, you had a silent record. Everybody agreed the record was silent, didn't shed any light on the issue. In this case, you have a record that everybody agrees doesn't shed any light on the issue. In Pickett, you had some non-binding authority on both sides of the issue that the parties were arguing supported their position. In this case, you have some non-binding authority on both sides of the issue as well. The main difference in Pickett, of course, was the remand was required because the district court in that case issued its order granting 225 relief under a lighter standard than Beeman before Beeman came out. But in order to determine that a remand was necessary, it was a government appeal. Of course, this court could have affirmed if he had met the burden on the existing record, the pre-remand record. Court held that he did not meet his burden. And again, we submit the record here is nearly identical to that record.
All right, Mr. Billings, let me ask you a question to try to get an answer to what the legal landscape was. Given our court's decisions on how to use the elements clause, 1998, and what federal kidnapping was, again, back in 1998. If the district court in sentencing Mr. Williams had based its ACCA ruling solely on the elements clause, we would have reversed, right?
I don't know that, Your Honor, but I think that's the problem.
Well, tell me how we would have affirmed.
Well, as we said in our
opinion, what an opinion would have looked like that would have affirmed a ruling by the district court that kidnapping counted under the elements clause, given the state of the law in 1998.
I think that the reasoning would have been similar to the reasoning of the Second Circuit en banc case and the Kaplansky case, where the court found it qualifies categorically under the residual clause, but also that particular conviction, because you can make a determination, as Taylor allowed, that the jury in that case necessarily would have convicted him of a crime that required force. And so,
but the problem is that our elements jurisprudence at the time was categorical.
Well, but I think that the elements issue is the government has to prove one or the other. It has to prove, to state it simply, deception or the use of force with kidnapping. And just like the court decided in Rayner, you could look at, in a burglary case, you could be convicted of a burglarizing a building, which would qualify, or burglarizing an automobile, which would not. And if you could look at the record, and again, Taylor, for qualifying documents, you could look and see that the jury necessarily convicted you of the one that the government had to prove beyond a reasonable doubt in order to convict you, that it would qualify. But I think the trap that I've fallen into considering this case and thinking about it, and what I want to emphasize to the court, is this idea that we're looking at the issue as if it had been fully litigated, fully briefed to the district court, what would the better answer have been? And what, asking this court to decide what was the better answer. But that's not the question before the court. It's a question of historical fact. And so even if you could look back and say that was the better answer, it doesn't meet his burden of establishing it as a matter of historical fact that the district court relied solely on the residual clause. And I think
that can't be right, because Beeman says that at least in some cases, the legal landscape is going to give you an answer when the underlying record is silent as to what the district court did. So I understand your position about this case, but it can't be that the legal landscape can never provide the answer for you with a silent record, right?
Well, no, Beeman allowed for that, and Pickett recognized that. But what Beeman said was, if the law was clear at the time of sentencing that only the residual clause would authorize a finding that the prior conviction was a violent felony, that circumstance would strongly point to a sentencing per the residual clause. Of course, even if you had a binding case that said it only qualified under the residual clause based on the Beeman test, but you had a judge who just erroneously found it qualified under the elements clause, as a matter of fact, and meeting his burden of proof in that hypothetical case, the petitioner would not be able to meet it. But I think the law has to be
But that's in a case where the district judge explains what he did, right?
Right, exactly right. You're right. I'm just saying that even if the law was clear, in a case like this, I think it needs to be much clearer than it is here. Of the nine cases he cites to support, or not necessarily to support, but he says addresses this issue or similar issues, only two of those cases address the particular statute we're talking about, federal kidnapping. That was this court's decision in Salami. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, where it found that it qualified under the elements clause in the guidelines context. I acknowledge that. And there's the Patino case, which is a Second Circuit case, where the court found in dicta, I acknowledge that as well, the court said it can't be questioned that it includes a threat of force against a person. And so those are the only two decisions that address the statute that he's pointed to, and both of them support a finding that the court could have relied upon the elements clause.
I think what about the Tenth Circuit decision in Phelps and the Ninth Circuit decision in Shirbati?
Well, all of these are non-binding, of course, Your Honor. And so the
of
court
course they are.
Right.
I know, but you're talking about Patino, which is also non-binding.
I agree. And I'm not trying to assert that the court necessarily would have relied upon the elements clause. That's not my burden. I'm not trying to say I know that. We don't know that. That's the point. But if you look at Pickett, the court really didn't give much credence to these non-binding, non-precedential, binding precedential decisions. And we think that's the same course that needs to be followed here in order to follow the decision in Pickett, because we're talking again about a question of historical fact. And the practical reality is, if you look at what Pickett said about it, for example, it talked about a decision that was unpublished and at that time in the table. And it talked about the practical reality that the judge probably wouldn't even have seen that decision. And so those practical considerations are applicable here too. I mean, a district court in this, if this issue had come up, the decision that probably would have been most persuasive, and in fact, this judge in this district court, in issuing its order denying 25 relief, characterized the Salimi decision as very persuasive. That's the case in the 11th Circuit, the only one that really addressed this issue head on. Again, it was in the guideline context, but as this court has repeatedly held, and even in Pickett acknowledges in a footnote, This court, because the two definitions are identical, generally interprets them the same way. So the district court in this case, finding that decision was very persuasive, is understandable. And certainly, again, we don't know that that was brought to his attention. As in Pickett, the court said, we don't even know if the district court gave thought to this issue. But when you don't know, the party with the burden loses. So Mr. Williams hasn't met his burden of proof. Again, we would urge this court just to compare the record in Pickett in this case, and they're very similar in terms of silent record, and you have some non-binding authority on both sides.
Mr. Billingsley?
Yes.
So explain to me, so this issue wasn't litigated at the sentencing court at the time, is that right?
That's correct.
So given that it wasn't litigated, how can we even ask the question of what the judge thought as a matter of historical fact? Go ahead.
I think it's difficult, right? Because again, you could have a judge who was wrong to find, if it thought about the elements clause and found that it qualified, it could be just obviously wrong. And that still would mean that the individual did not meet his or her burden. I think that looking to the case law, and if you look at Pickett and you look at Beeman, they talk about making it clear that you would, I assume, then they say it would be strong evidence because you would presume that a judge followed the law. And so if you had a case in the 11th Circuit that said this kidnapping qualifies under the residual clause and only the residual clause, the absence of anything else, it seems a presumption that the judge would follow that decision, or maybe that's the reason it wasn't litigated because everybody knew that decision was there and that's why there was no objection. That in that kind of a circumstance, you could meet your burden of proof, but there's nothing like that here. Again, most closely on point decision in the 11th Circuit found that it had inherently involved the threat of force. That's the same decision.
And given that the issue wasn't litigated and we don't have a ruling on it, isn't it possible that the judge just saw that one of these crimes was kidnapping and just assumed it's a kidnapping crime? It must have an element of force involved.
I think absolutely, Your Honor. I think that's possible. And you know, if you refer back to that Second Circuit decision, the court says that the crime of kidnapping involves a threatened use of physical force against a person and thus is a crime of violence under this statute cannot be questioned. Patino, that's what the court just reactively thought. It may be that the parties didn't object because of that reaction. But the fact is there's nothing to tell us one way or the other. And Pickett and Beeman, you know, have said if you can't tell one way or the other, you haven't met your burden of proof.
Mr. Billingsley, one more question, if I might.
Sure.
I didn't see you lay out what you think is the appropriate standard of review with regard to the district court's decision. What do you think that is?
Well, I think in this instance, especially because you have a district court who was the same judge that sentenced the individual, it's a question of fact that's entitled to some deference. Now, I understand that, you know, generally the way I think of that is questions are entitled to deference because the judge was in a better position to make the determination. So I understand Mr. Smith's argument that that's not true here, but I think because it was the same judge, it's entitled to some deference. It may be entitled to deference anyway because it's a question of fact, but certainly in this case, it's entitled to some deference because you're talking about the same judge who sentenced the individual deciding on the 2255 in terms of this question, whether he has established more likely than not that the residual clause and only the residual clause was the basis for the enhancement.
Thank you.
The last point I would just make is that the idea that the residual clause would be the easier way to analyze the issue, the sort of the catch-all, that I think that argument was rejected in both Beeman and Pickett. So if there are no further questions, we would just ask this court to respectfully to affirm the decision of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I'm gonna touch on just a few points that the government has raised here. First, briefly regarding the standard of review, deference would obviously be warranted if the district judge who, as Mr. Billingsley correctly notes, had been the sentencing judge, if he had purported to draw on his own recollection in any way. He did not. He didn't explicitly say, I don't recall, but he looked only to the state of the law. And that is something that this court is at least as well positioned to review as the district court was. It's therefore a primarily a legal question, and that makes it appropriate for de novo review. Second, the government talks about the lack of clarity in the law at the time of sentencing, but when it does that, it's talking only about the fact about the law regarding the classification of kidnapping and similar offenses under the ACCA and crime of violence definitions. And there was not absolute clarity there, but there was very clear precedent that was binding in this circuit and binding on the sentencing court about the interpretation of the federal kidnapping statute and its elements. There was also very clear law in this circuit about how the elements clause would be applied, and that it would be applied only based on elements, not offense details. Ultimately here, we believe the district court misapplied Beeman in concluding that Mr. Williams could not carry his burden unless it was entirely clear, and the government echoes this argument, unless it was entirely clear that the ACCA's residual clause was the only basis for classifying a federal kidnapping offense as a violent felony. Beeman did not change the preponderance of the evidence burden of proof and persuasion that this court's precedents impose and have for decades imposed on 2255 movements. And really, nationally, there is a consensus across circuits that a 2255 movements burden is a preponderance burden. Pickett expressly stated a Johnson 2255 claim can succeed in the face of some uncertainty. So the lack of absolute clarity here simply doesn't resolve the matter. Finally, the last point I want to respond to is that the government's argument that the sentencing court might also or instead have relied on the elements clause is fundamentally an argument that the sentencing court might have misapplied clearly established principles, and that creates uncertainty, and because of that uncertainty, Mr. Williams can't carry his burden. The government uses the specter of error, the possibility that the sentencing court might have applied the elements clause to an offense with no force element, and argues that Mr. Williams can't carry his burden simply because of this possibility of error, of misapplication of the law. I believe that's wrong for three reasons. One, it overstates a preponderance burden, as I've said. Two, it gives the sentencing court too little credit for being able to correctly apply clear legal principles in force at the time of sentencing. Three, there's a fundamental unfairness here. Mr. Williams, this sentencing court either relied only on the residual clause, which would make the sentence unconstitutional, or it misapplied precedent. And the government is ultimately asking this court to uphold an unconstitutional sentence based on the possibility the court misapplied the law. I'd like to thank the court for its time and ask to reverse the denial of the 2255 motion.
All right, thank you, Mr. Smith. Thank you both very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.